Welcome into Momentous Struggle, a Star Wars Shatterpoint podcast. This week's episode is a little bit different. Aubrey and I were just coming back from Adepticon, so we're not really going to be able to do a whole lot as far as talking about what we were doing, what like a main episode or anything along those lines. So instead, what I'm going to be doing is going ahead and putting up the interview that I had with Will Schick as an episode for this week. So everyone has a chance to listen to it. If you missed it while we were on, when we were streaming it live, it's going to go ahead and just get cut down. So just for that interview piece, for you to go ahead and listen to. I'm also going to get that cut up and able to watch on YouTube as well. So if you're watching on YouTube, awesome. Leave, rate, review the podcast. Go ahead and, or the, not rate, review the podcast. Sorry about that. Go ahead and like, subscribe. Let us know what you think about the interview down below. If you are listening to us on whatever podcast platform you are listening to us on, of course, rate, review the podcast. Let us know what you're thinking there. One other thing, if you do enjoy the content you're listening to and want to help support the channel in any way, by all means, we do have a Patreon. We'll go ahead and link that in the description below. Just $1 a month that will go ahead and help us, let us know that what we're doing is good and helping you out and you're enjoying listening to it. You can go for some of the larger, higher tiers as well, but $1 a month, we want to make this affordable if you are looking to sit there and help us out with the content that we are making. In return, we go ahead and we'll get you into our patron only section of our Discord. We also do like to send out you some stickers if you want to give us your address and let you send out a Momentous Struggle sticker for you, as well as you get additional entries into any giveaways that we do. We are doing one for all of the Adepticon swag that we had gotten. We did get a bunch of prize wall stuff, so we're going to be doing a couple different giveaways for that. So look forward to that. If you want to go ahead and jump on the Patreon, that does give you some bonus entries. If not, there is a YouTube video for that as well. So go ahead and check that out. Like and subscribe and leave a comment in that and you will be automatically entered into that contest. We're going to be giving away a couple of different things there. So there's going to be multiple chances to win. So without further ado, though, we're going to go ahead and jump into this interview with Will Schick and enjoy.
Oh, so here's this guy that likes to do stuff at AMD. Mr. Schick? You do not look excited to be here. Are you tired already?
No, I'm just, just trying to figure out how to use, you know, headphones.
It's a tough thing.
It is.
It's a tough thing. How are you doing today?
I'm doing good. How was the last game? How are things going?
It was fantastic. I mean, we got Amon and Jesse, so they're just really fantastic players. So it was a very clean, very great game. So yeah, well, pleasure to have you.
Good to be here. Thank you for having me.
Outstanding. I was excited. I mean, like, I've seen you on stream painting a lot, especially like over COVID. It was like you painting in your garage.
I was in my laundry room /office over COVID because that was the only room that was available at the time to work in. So you could always see my washing machine and my dryer behind me. Yep. I was like, you know what? We're just making it work.
Just gonna make it work.
I love doing it.
Yeah, that was great. I mean, like, and it was right when that game came out, especially, it was like, that's what first got me into miniature gaming. And then you came over to Star Wars. I'm like, yes.
Here we go. That was very exciting. Yeah, like, you know, we started with Marvel, but the idea that we could always move into, you know, the Star Wars galaxy and do some cool stuff with it, and kind of bring our own twist or ideas on the skirmish game side of it, you know, with Legion being such a great Star Wars, like, war game, right? Big battles, and it was really killing it in that way. So trying to offer something a little different perspective-wise and fill out the overall, you know, complement of Star Wars experiences, from big fleet battles to starship battles to mass action battles, all the way down to
the skirmish.
Heroic skirmish, and kind of get a little bit more of that animated, like, Saturday morning cartoon feel into Star Wars as well, because I think each game has a really great theme around them. And so we were like, well, if we're going to do heroes, let's just do it. You know, let's do it fun. Let's do it energetic. Let's do it frenetic and see what happens. So
I love it.
It was a blast. It was very exciting to learn that was going to be an opportunity we had, and then to just really dive in and get to do it and make it a labor of love that, you know, by the time it came out, we were really chomping it. We were like, come on now. We want the world to see it.
There was a lot of work that went into that. So, I mean, I think when people first heard that you guys were talking about this, I was like, oh, is this just going to be MCP with Star Wars characters? And I know that you wanted to make sure that you didn't go down that path. Were there any type of mechanics that you're like, well, this would be really cool in Shatterpoint, in our Star Wars game?
So, I mean, I think, like, you know, from direct ports, right, there wasn't really anything from Crisis Protocol that we said, we want this in Shatterpoint. I think there were concepts, though, right? Like all good things, right? There are ingredients that you want in your dish to make it taste really good. And so one of the big things that we love from a design and development perspective, I think always makes games more interesting, is resource mechanics. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the idea of the force versus the power system in Crisis Protocol, you can definitely draw comparisons there, right? They're how you activate your character's stronger abilities. They're a thing that you have to manage and think about over the course of play. And giving players that choice, that opportunity to spend their resources wisely or unwisely, or to take big gambles with it, it really unlocks, I think, something that makes games more enjoyable, which is that you and I can sit down and have the exact same game. Like, we could play the exact same opponent, the exact same moves, but the way in which we choose to spend those resources, already that changes everything for us. You know, you might be more conservative, you might decide to spread it out. I might decide to go for a big play and spend it all on an Anakin turn or something like that. So the resource mechanic thing was definitely one that we knew we wanted in there from the start. And with Star Wars, you know, the Force is such a present and important thing that using that as a thematic tie-in was really good. And then, of course, there were things, you know, like we knew we wanted to utilize symbolic dice and have the math kind of obfuscated or easier for players to do to really make sure that combat resolution, which we knew was going to be pretty heavy with the combat trees, relatively easy to calculate, and then you can move through all of the complex choices on the trees and stuff like that. And that's similar to how Crisis Protocol has, you know, its symbolic dice. It hides the math from making the players go, okay, let's do some counting and some subtraction and things like that, and instead says, look at the symbols, count them up, very easy calculations.
Yeah.
It allows you to stay in the game rather than coming back out, which I think is important for these kinds of skirmish games where you really want the action to move quickly. You know, you want things to move at a pace. And then the last one was, you know, the movement templates and the range tools. And that also comes from a player accessibility standpoint. When you're talking about Star Wars, you know you're going to get interest from a lot of people. We want to make sure the game is as open and welcoming to people who have never experienced the miniatures game before. This might be their first foray in. And, you know, like saying, okay, it's very easy to be like, use this tool to measure movement. Use this tool to see if you're in range. It gets a little scarier for people, I've found, over my course of working in miniatures games, when you're like, you need a tape measure. And they're like, oh, dear.
Yeah.
Like, this sounds like it's going to be complex. And it's like, it's really not. But those ways in which you can, you know, you can open the accessibility up and you can make the hurdles that aren't really hurdles less noticeable to people, those were the kinds of things that we borrowed. Now, there was one thing we ported directly over in our testing that we knew we weren't going to keep, but it allowed us to immediately start developing the game in a way that we needed to, which was originally the game used Crisis Protocol scenarios.
Okay.
So we started with the idea of extract objectives and secure objectives, and how does that work, and what does it mean? Because we needed a way to start playing the game and testing. But we knew that would iterate and change. We didn't know how much. And, of course, where we wound up with the way the struggle and the mission decks work and the tracker and all that, radically different in ways that I don't think no one predicted, but it was an organic process that was very painful at the time, because every time you would rewrite the mission system, you'd have to go back and rebalance what the units were doing, how they functioned. Certain abilities and stuff would just be meaningless. But it was one of the biggest challenges to get to where we wound up, but I think where we ended up, like, fits the game and the pace and what we want out of it so well. And it does have opportunities that we're going to be exploring here in the next year or so to offer different versions of the experience. And I'm really excited to start moving into that. So it's a little bit of a preview spoiler into, like, what's coming in the next several months. Is going to be, we've had a really great establishment of not quite a year, but we're getting close. And the game system's really flying. And now we get to have the fun part of saying, okay, let's talk about all these crazy ideas that are kind of outside the norm of the base game that I think will bring players a lot of really fun options and opportunities that we have also seen. And that's another, I guess, ties into your question. What did you directly port over to Crisis Protocol? The concept of, we're going to create a really solid foundation, and then from there we're going to start to really explore what we can do with that foundation.
Start adding little pieces and how we can just bring stuff in. Just a little spice here, a little spice there, and just get that flavor just right.
You know, like, the thing we always ask ourselves is, okay, well, how do we do X, Y, or Z iconic movement, right? Like, how do you do the Rogue One ending where Vader's going through the corridor and like slaughtering everyone, and they're trying desperately to get the plans out.
Yes.
Right? What does that look like in Shatterpoint? How do you capture that narrative and theme in a way that players can reenact it in some way? And those things are always outside of the standard base game, because they typically require some asymmetry. They require a little bit of unbalance. They may tweak or change rules. So it's really important to have that really solid base. And then from there, sky's the limit. As long as you're planning for that along the way. And that's something that we always try to do as well.
Outstanding. Yeah. I mean, that kind of leads into like where I wanted to go next was, you want these dynamic, like iconic characters that do these like dynamic, iconic things, but you still need to have a balanced game.
Yeah.
And that's like, you don't want to have that broken piece that now you got to go back 6 months later and, okay, here's the nerf that everyone's been screaming for. Hi, here's how I fix whatever that you think is broken. Yeah. How is it that you sit there and like, how does that process work to make sure that you balance the iconic character versus the not, what's the balancing of the game?
Yeah, so, I mean, that's the challenge every day, right? The biggest thing is that we always rely heavily on our internal testing, our external testing. As games get older and they become more like played in the community, you can get data points and feedbacks from thousands of games rather than hundreds of games. We always talk about how, you know, We're really craftsmen. We're hobbyists on a game development journey and a sculpting journey. We learn over every day. We learn new things, and then we can implement those things. So the big challenge is before you have any of those data points internally, you really have to like zone in. You have to say, okay, we know from experience that X, Y, or Z works this way. You've voraciously taken data points from other games, from other systems, from personal experience, as well as the testing that's actively going on. And you try to take lessons that may not be directly applicable to what you're working on, but then try to apply them and say, okay, well, I've seen games do this well. How do we implement that idea here? Or are we doing that? And then you say, well, I've seen game systems really fall down or fail here. I didn't like this personally. How do we make sure that we're not doing that if it's within the game? But the core of it is to understand that, you know, the games are not perfectly balanced. That's what makes the characters interesting. So number one, you go in and you say, you know what? In a point system and a character system like Shatterpoint, where you're talking about, you know, single digits for the most part in terms of how you're separating these characters and these units, you're going to have certain things that are at slightly above the curve and slightly below the curve. You're going to have squad point three things that are, you know, like not as good as some other things. And that's okay, as long as that we always talk about the curve. So what we accept is the fact that there's always going to be a top, there's always going to be a bottom. Because if everything was the same, then we would effectively all be playing with the exact same pieces. Like, everything mathematically would have to be identical. And then you get into the whole, like, chess question, right? Like, is chess a perfectly balanced game? It's not, because somebody has to go first, right? So already there's one imbalance, exactly. And you have to work around it. So what we do is we just try to squish that bell curve as tight as possible. And from there, once you've identified, and your bell curve can be as big, as wide as you feel like from a development perspective is achievable. We like narrow ones. And then once you've established that, then what you do is you start watching, you say, okay, this is a little out of bounds, this is a little out of bounds. Now, once a game like Shatterpoint comes out, you start to see how players adopt things. And this is the best and scariest part about any development, is that your goal is to make sure that you've plugged all of the major holes.
Yeah.
Right? And then you present this thing, you say, okay, here it is. And you know from the very onset that people are going to do things with that system that you never expected.
Yeah. I mean, players are going to want to break it.
They are. Well, and players are really smart and they're innovative and they can iterate, and you get different perspectives, right? The difference in regional metas and what people believe and what they, you know, what works within their systems, it's entirely different. So, you know, your goal as a developer is to make sure that there's nothing that can be bent so far that it breaks.
Right.
And then if something happens like that, then the hard work begins, where you have to go back and you have to say, okay, we have to get all the data, we have to look at everything, and then we have to say, what are the ripple effects, right? Because every change that you make has impact on everything else. Yeah. And that becomes even more complex when you talk about our production timelines, because we're making things over the course of 2 years. So we have tested things that are at a printer right now based on the way it was. So when you say, okay, well, this was perfectly fine and it's at print, But now we believe that we have to make this change here because of good reasons. Like, we've established all the data and we're saying, well, this needs a balance up or down. It doesn't really matter. You not only have to say, okay, well, how does this affect everything that currently exists and things that are in testing? But you also have to say, well, there's things in print we can't change. How does it affect that? Like, we don't want to run into a situation where you make a change and that change means that you have to make more changes. And, you know, they kind of
it
like
just goes the ripple effect.
Yeah, they snowball down. So we're very slow to make changes. We're very considerate about the changes we're going to make if we have to make them. But I think, you know, we all accept the idea that these games, I always use the gardening, you know, metaphor if you've ever listened to me talk before, because I think it's, one, I'm a one-trick pony, and two, it's, you know, it just logically for me, it makes perfect sense, and it's how we approach everything, which is these games are alive. You know, they're organic, and they grow. We plant seeds, and those seeds grow, and we have an idea of what we want the garden to look like. But the reality of the situation is if you overtend a living thing, it dies. You know, it atrophies. It doesn't succeed. So when a branch or a flower shows up and you're like, well, I didn't think one would be there, you know, you're overcrowding into the azaleas. I don't know if I like that. But you have to give it time to see, right? You have to see how it interacts with things. You can't just go in and start snipping branches.
Exactly.
And so, you know, from that perspective, from the gardening perspective, you know that you're going to have to weed eat sometimes. You know you're going to have to do some trimming. And those things are fine, but they need to be done carefully and considerately. And so what we do is we do a lot of, like, you know, there's no communication. Then all of a sudden it's like, all right, well, we've made our decision. We've tested everything. We've looked at all the possibilities. And now it's time to move something forward. But it leads to a much more conservative, you know, we have a much more conservative take than other studios because of that, because we want to make sure that all of these interactions are taken care of. And additionally, and this is one that I always like to bring up too, is that we talked about players being innovative and doing things that you don't expect. A lot of the times, you know, when things come out, we always aim for those characters to be very interesting, to do things that feel like the character. And we want to push against the limits of the bubble, right? Mm-hmm. We want to see the game expand and grow. We want to see characters do things we've never seen before that work within the systems of the game and within the theme of themselves. And that means that puts pressure on what players expect, right? When the new thing comes out, nobody's practiced against it. So all of a sudden it's like, oh, this is real. I don't know how to deal with this. This is really good. And that can sometimes turn into, it's too powerful. It needs an adjustment.
Right.
And so we take that feedback and we're like, all right, well, we're going to put it on the little war board we have and we're going to talk about it every week and we're going to say, what are the developments? But at the same time, you know, internally, we might say, well, I would solve that problem by doing this list.
Right.
Or I would use these characters. And it's just this character that the community has kind of forgotten about. If you start putting them here, it pushes back against this pressure. And when the players figure that out and you see them naturally evolve the meta as we want them to do, as this living kind of garden works, that's a moment that's very satisfying as a developer and a designer, because that's what the games are intended to do. But B, I love watching the community like hit those moments, those aha moments, those galaxy brain moments, and see the excitement of the person who innovated, see the excitement of the community around them to be like, oh my gosh, that's an amazing thought. I didn't think about this, or I didn't think about this approach. You know, solving those problems is such a big positive hit, right? As humans, we're creative problem solvers. We like to think our ways out of things. So when you can do that in games like this, I think that's one of the things that keeps you coming back, right?
Oh, without
a
doubt.
It's what keeps the game fresh and exciting. So it's a lot of balancing that. It is very difficult. And there's moments where, you know, like when we were going to announce Shatterpoint, it's like, okay, well, there's no going back. And then it was, now they know it's coming. Now we have to explain to them how it works. And you're just like, I think they'll like it. I hope they're like, I like it. You like it, right? And it's like, you like it, right? And they're like, yeah, I like it. And then you just kind of watch and you wait.
Yeah.
And you hope that you've done something that inspires people, that excites them, that delivers on their dreams for what they want to see out of the game, to live in the galaxy, to like be these characters. And you know, fortunately, like, it seems like the community around Shatterpoint has really adopted it and found things and innovated and come up with like so many cool things. And the game is so young that there's so much left to go. There's so much in the pipe that the other fun part is just watching the evolution and the growth, right? Like when all you have is like a Grievous and a Vader, it's like these guys are, they're horrible monsters on the table. They just keep coming at you. It's like, yep, but
there might be something.
There's some things, you know, there's some things, there's plans. So, and that goes back to the other thing about, you know, being careful and considerate is you want to build in questions and then you want to put in answers, right? Yeah. And you want to make sure that the players always have enough tools to be able to solve things, knowing, again, that bell curve, there's always going to be something that's a little bit at the top and a little bit at the bottom.
I mean, you can only release so many models at a time.
Yeah.
So it's like, yeah, there is going to be, like, Vader was, like, the boogeyman,
yeah,
like a couple months ago, and it's like, oh, the sky is falling, What are we going to do? AMG, fix this now.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like, you give it a couple months, it's like, okay, we figured it out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, okay, here are the ways to do it. It's like, sometimes you just got to let yourself grow and, like, figure out the problem yourself and go from there.
Pagani has a really great litmus test that he always imparts to everyone, having done this forever and just being a genius lead developer, right? He says, the only time something immediately needs addressing is if the only solution you can find to it is itself, right? So if the only way to confront an oppressive problem is by using the exact same thing, that's when it goes to the top of the board. And we're like, okay, we clearly have a very big problem. We need to address this because that is not okay. But if it just has a higher win percentage, it depends on what that wins percentage is or how people are using it or things like that. So again, it's every data point we can get is really important. Adepticon is an amazing opportunity for us because we get to see so much high-level competitive play, but also we all get to talk to a ton of people who just play in the free play areas. You know, you get all these different player perspectives and skill levels, and it really kind of clarifies and is a good litmus test against all of the data you get across the rest of the year from people talking and stuff. So when we get back to the office, that's usually the most frenetic that we get as a group, and we're talking about everything. And you know, that goes down from dev all the way to sculpting to art and everything else. It's a very energizing experience.
It sounds
for
like
us.
It's just fun, like the whole team just coming together and creating that. So creation wise, what is it like, if like looking at Star Wars, like what is your dream character that you would just love to create?
Oh. All right, so I assume this is a character that hasn't been made yet.
Yeah.
I would love to do a Pong Krell.
Okay.
Because, one, I think the character design is phenomenal. Like, when he showed up in the Umbra arc, I was just like, this guy is cool. Yes. And then it turned out that he was an asshole. And I was like, ah. But he's so cool. Until he had his whole villainous turn, spoilers for a show that's pretty old now.
Right.
I was kind of with him on the whole, like, I understand your perspective. Like, the clones are just troopers. You're treating them more like droids, which is probably not exactly the most Jedi thing. But, like, you know, they're military commanders. They're going to have different views on, like, how their troops. And he needs to accomplish his objective. His goal is to win the war. Okay. But then it just turned. But I was like, he's so cool. Like, the two double-bladed lightsabers. Like, when I saw that, I was like, this is amazing.
So since Shatterpoint is that moment in time, would it be Krell before or after the turn?
I mean, that would be very selfish for me to get away with both. You know, if I was to throw him on paper right now, what we would probably do for a character like Krell, because he's only in, you know, like a 4-episode, 5-episode arc, is we would probably hit him at the midline, right? Like, thematically, you would want to give him, okay, he's a very no-nonsense general, and he knows how to lead his troops, and he's willing to do what it takes for victory. But he's got some dark side tendencies. Like, he's got some evil to him, right? So doing something like he damages clones to give them an effect, right? Get some of that Empire flavor, potentially. Because that's one of the big themes in the Empire units that people are seeing, right? Is the idea that they can do stuff, but it comes at personal expense. It always comes at damage.
Right.
And that was kind of introduced with the original Vader, but it's been pushed into, like, Stormtroopers and everything else. And you'll see that as a trend going forward, that the Empire is very self-inflictive. And so they kind of wear themselves down in the hopes that they can beat you faster by being more aggressive and more, like, opportunistic in that way. And so that would be, you know, like, off the cuff, that would definitely be something that I'd be looking at in terms of what does a Pong Krell look like? He would do something that you'd be like, all right, he can get more out of his clones, but it's not good for them.
Right.
Right? And then you start thinking about it, and it's like, well, that's not the Jedi way. The Jedi are all about boosting the troops and taking personal risks. You know, the Plo Koon who can step in front and protect his troops, the Obi-Wan who's very much about knowledge and defense, you know, and he makes his troops safer. Anakin Skywalker who inspires his troops. He doesn't necessarily do anything for them, but he builds them up and he's always on the front line. Then you get somebody like a Pong Krell and it's like, oh yeah, he's just murdering them. like slowly and surely so that he can win, but he is murdering them.
But I mean, he was still doing that even when he was
you can see where he's going, right? So we're kind of like in the midline. We understand that this guy is not the nicest guy, and we can see that path. And those are, you know, those are some of the fun development and design considerations we take when we're looking at characters.
Makes sense.
Are we going to see, do we see this character over multiple pieces of media? Do we see them grow and evolve and all that? Or are they kind of more self-contained? And then how do we frame enough so that we get the full view of the character? Because we know we might only do them once. And I think Ponkrell is definitely one that would be like one and done.
Yeah. He's not a Vader. He's not a Luke. He's not one of those where you're going to see multiple times over and over again. So if you were to sit down and play a game with somebody here locally at Adepticon, mm-hmm. what is the strike team that you're bringing?
Oh, okay. I think right now, if I was going to bring a strike team, it would probably be Obi-Wan, Padawan Ahsoka, and the Clone Commandos.
Okay.
Make sure that the points work in my head, because I have to go without my cards.
I played that exact squad just a week ago. So,
so it would be that, and then I would take the Cad Bane box.
The Cad Bane box?
Yeah.
Interesting. I haven't got a lot of reps with Aura Sing yet. And, like, there's people are out, like, they're so wishy-washy with Aura, whether, like...
I think Aura Sing is boom or bust, right?
Yeah.
Like, you either get in situations where she can just crush it and mm-hmm. she feels entirely unfair, or she winds up in situations where she's either lukewarm or she just gets dusted right away.
Makes sense.
Michael Plummer, our lead dev for Shatterpoint, he loves Aura Sing. He plays her a lot, along with Asajj, and he can get some amazing plays out of her. Like, I think her, you know, it always comes down to if a character can do a lot of things, then it becomes like more focused characters are easy to get the most out of because you know what they want to do. Or it's like, do I double tap? Do I run away? Do I, you know, how? And then you have to set up, if you want to get the most out of her, you have to set up, you know, those distractions. You have to get your troops in there so that she can get her extra dice.
Yep.
And then there's always that, you know, right now, especially with the missions that are available for the most part, long-range sniper characters like she kind of is, she doesn't necessarily want to get in there and mix it up. They do have a little bit of an uphill climb because the game currently in both mission sets does start to force you to start engaging, right?
Yeah.
And I think that there are opportunities and potential in the future as more mission sets are released that dynamic will also somewhat shift.
Okay.
Shatterpoint will always be a game about, you know, finally getting in close in the scrum because you have to fight over those objectives. But one of the neat things from a mission design perspective is how those tokens are laid out, how they activate and turn on during the various struggles does allow different strike teams opportunities to maximize them, and it becomes part of that player choice and that opportunity.
Makes sense. So what, if you can go into it, mission pack wise, I mean, we're almost at a year now mm-hmm. at the game. I mean, what is the goal of like missions to come out and be in the community?
So the original goal was by a year in, we would have 3 mission packs, which provides quite a bit of variety. You know, the pacing of them was intentional on the idea that there's a lot going on in Shepard. There's a lot to learn. And for traditional miniatures players or people who have played miniatures games before, there's a lot to unlearn, right? Shatterpoint, as we've discussed in several different, like when we were talking about the game originally and in other places, intentionally we ask ourselves at every turn, like, okay, a traditional miniatures game would have this. Do we need that? Does removing that create more of the experience we want? So, for example, like Shatterpoint doesn't have rounds. It's just, you just keep going. It has a random order activation stack, things like that. So we didn't want to overload players with too much too quickly. And so the initial mission pack was like, okay, we're going to let them learn the game. It doesn't really introduce a lot of questions. It works well with what we knew was going to be the initial launch waves. And from there, we start to build, you know, in mission pack 2, we started to add some extra things to think about. So you have, you know, you have the unique mission rules that go along with each struggle. So you don't necessarily know which ones you're going to activate. They add an extra layer of things to consider as you're playing through the game. Mission pack 3 kind of culminates that with some new ideas and, you know, a new layout and all, of course, everything that you would expect. But it amplifies the game. And so from those 3, you have a lot of opportunities to maximize different strike team compositions, and then also kind of you as a player decide, well, I really like these layouts, I don't like these layouts. I know how to predict these things or not. And then from there, the goal is to regularly expand on more missions. Those first three are kind of the core base ones, right? So they're going to be the ones that you're always going to be able to take in any setting, like an event that's a tournament or just for a local game and pickup. But, you know, the reality is that tournament play and competitive play is only a small slice of the overall, like, pie. So I talked a little bit about, you know, where we go next, new game modes, new mission types, things that are not necessarily created for a tournament, like, base level of play. Things that you wouldn't see at, you know, an Adepticon event, like a Premier Showdown or things like that. So we're going to be going with those. Those will add new gameplay and opportunity perspectives. They'll be more thematic, more narrative. They'll do things that are going to be very fun and allow players more freedom and flexibility when they want to sit down to play a Shatterpoint game to say, well, let's play the base experience. Let's play one of these narrative or thematic experiences. You're going to get all the good Shatterpoint action, but it's feel very different. And then additional mission packs, like the ones that we've seen so far with the first three, they're going to, of course, continue to evolve what that stuff works, but they're always, those mission packs will typically be balanced around the idea that they will work within the tournament or the competitive slice of the game, right? Mm-hmm. So they're always going to provide a, as most balanced, unbalanced, you know, because the game is perfectly unbalanced, right? They're going to provide the most perfectly unbalanced experience that you can possibly have so that that continues to build on that foundation of the game.
Okay. So you're looking more like, good to tap into like the MCP side, oh my gosh, I lost the name of the symbiote one.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Like that scenario is like the best free-for-all
yeah.
experience and the best way to learn how to play MCP, in my opinion, just because it's like you have four people going all at once and you're working one against three, basically. Are we looking at something like that? Is that something in the future potentially for it?
Yeah, I think so. You know, like, again, now that we have a good solid foundation, you know, as the game gets to its one-year mark, the goal is to not only just continue to expand on that mark, right? New basic mission packs, new things that will push the game forward, but also to really start to explore what can Shatterpoint offer players, right? Because, again, Well, we do all of our design to be perfectly unbalanced for a base level of play, which is what allows it to do really well. You know, a good balance like that allows it to be played at a high competitive level. Our goal is not to create a competitive game. Our goal is to create a great miniatures experience that you and your friends and your opponents can play and have incredible, like, events happen on the table that you control and have this shared experience over the tabletop. It always goes back to the point, or the goal of the game is to win, but the point of the game is to have fun, right? So in that way, you know, once you kind of look at it that way, then you really open up all of the possibilities and the potential for a game. Because if you say, well, we're just going to make sure everything is as fine-tuned, as perfectly balanced as possible, because we want it to just be the best tournament game it can ever be, all of a sudden now, right? Everything has to fall within this very narrow window, and eventually you're just going to be like, well, there's no way that this thing could be better than that. And we can't do cool things because that would push us out of our very narrow boundaries, right? Instead, when you say, well, competitive play, in essence, tournaments are a game mode themselves because they already break the core rules of the game. And I know this might blow some people's minds. They'll be like, what do you mean? They use the exact same base rules. It's like, no, they don't, because they have a round timer, right? A real game of Shatterpoint, a true standard experience of Shatterpoint, has no time limit. There's no you have to be done in 2 hours in the rule book, right? Now, that's required for an event like this so that it can run smoothly, but already, you know, having mission critical in your event packet fundamentally changes how the game plays. It changes some of the inherent strategies. It changes the player approach. And I think that's very cool, and I know a lot of players really love that, and I think that's great, but it's important to always keep in mind that competitive versions of any game, you know, whether it's Crisis Protocol, Legion, X-Wing, whatever, they're not the true base game experience that you start playing. They are a different game mode that does a very specific thing. So when we're looking at designing and creating for the game, we're always looking at that base game mode and then how do we go out from there and making sure that all of the things we offer have value to those different, you know, those different versions. Some are less, you know, less pressing than others. Like if we create a really cool multiplayer scenario, for example, that is a big old free for all, we're not gonna evaluate every new release or every new character that we're making against that mode.
Yeah.
We're gonna balance and look at it for like a tournament mode, because obviously tournaments are a very important slice of the pie. Whereas a free for all mode is like it's literally just chaos. It's for fun. We don't have to worry about that. And so those things kind of become a lot of the consideration and care as well as you look at that stuff. So yeah, like free for all modes, narrative modes, who knows what else? Like we're always looking for things that we can do that's really interesting.
Gonk racing
does use a lot of Shatterpoint stuff as well. Not quite the characters, but the gonks for sure. Yeah, it's just things like that, right? We want to create the most robust game that we possibly can that allows players who spend all this time, you know, hobbying and painting and assembling and collecting these characters that they love, all the opportunities they can to use them, you know, to have an enjoyable time with them and to maybe reach out to people who wouldn't necessarily be, you know, interested in the base experience, but maybe interested in something that's like a little lighter, a little more chaotic, a little more like groupthink, co-op, semi-co-op, things like that. Who knows? But those are the things that we love to work on. And personally, from my perspective, those are the things that excite me about games, is all the different potentials that you can do with them.
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, like, when I first picked up this game, like my friend Aubrey, who does my podcast with me, it was him and his stepson, like, learning to play the game together. So basically, it was like, each one of them a squad, and it was like 1v2 type of a game. And it's like, the ability to just have that, where like, okay, this is your squad, this is my squad, and having just different modes that are available just through this game that you created is amazing. I mean, are you looking at that, like going that route, where it's like 3 versus 1 type of thing, like kind of like the Hulk version, where it's like, yeah, everybody's teamed up going up against Hulk, like everybody's teamed up, like your squad's going against Super Vader or something like that?
Yeah, I mean, I think we've definitely had those conversations, and those dreams have been around, right? Since we started, because we obviously have had so much fun doing that in the other games that we've done, that is something we definitely want to port over here. Those things will just, you know, they take a little bit of time. You want to make sure that they're designed and developed well, but you can't introduce them too quickly, right? You have to make sure that we have to build a solid foundation with that base game experience, and then we grow from there. And excitingly, right? Before the end of the year, you're going to start seeing some of that exploration and some of that stuff coming out. So, I'm really thrilled with what's coming next and what we get to show and all of that, and where this game has the potential to go and where we kind of want to take it and some of the zany things that we've been trying to noodle on and figure out. But you know, obviously the dream is can we do the big death battle in episode 2 when, you know, they're going to be executed by the big monsters,
right?
Have them run in there, because that's a Shatterpoint moment for sure,
right?
Can you do like Luke versus the Rancor in Return of the Jedi? Like, can you do again the Rogue One hallway scene, right, with Vader just tearing his way through? Like, what if you just only took supports and you had to fight a Super Vader? Like, who knows, right? All of these things have potential, and they have the ability or seeds to be planted that could grow to fruition in the game. And we just don't close ourselves off to any of that stuff, right? We're always looking for good ideas and things that could be very fun and that, again, you know, just expand what Shatterpoint can mean to all the people out there.
Awesome. We're looking forward to the future of it. So I know you probably got to get out of here pretty quick.
I mean, I'm good until you have to kick me out for your next game.
We're on lunch break. So
oh, my gosh. Well, I don't want to hold you back from lunch either, but ask all the questions you want. We'll run through it.
I think that was about all I wanted to cover. I really wanted to get into, like, Europe and, you know, how you go through the dev process. Mm-hmm. I mean, is there something in the pipeline that you can sit there and, like, give us a little bit of teaser before Sunday on?
let me think. I got to think about what we're showing on Sunday, what we showed otherwise, and everything else. I don't think so. I think anything that I say would totally like spoil would spoil everything. No, I mean,
because we I put you on the spot.
I know. So the Bad Batch. The Bad Batch has been previewed by everyone. That was one of the big ones.
Yes.
Because you know it starts to. It kind of gives us more clones. It gives us the first clone primary, all that stuff. So that was a very, interesting and fun one to work on, especially with how the crosshairs and stuff. I'll say this. I know that people are somewhat confused or a little disappointed that the crosshairs that they've seen is not Cross Era. Well, if you listen to what we talked about previously of characters that get one version and characters that get multiple versions because they have a character arc, then maybe on Sunday you might understand why.
All right. I like it. That's enough speculation, I think, to get people going. Love it. But yeah, no, I'm super excited. I've been, from the day that this game was announced, I was like all in. I was sold.
Awesome. And well, so I was very, appreciate your support and your excitement.
Oh, like, definitely. I mean, that's like, and I'm locally in Arizona, so like a lot of us, like we have a very big community. I mean, I know that the OP is like really not the way you guys are going to be doing. Is there any sort of like, even like you did like OP like with like Parker Luck and everything like that? Are there OP kits that will be coming out for more, just even for organized play, just for local store events?
Yeah.
Like that?
So one of the big things that we're going to be pushing on over the course of the next year is to get more support locally for events. For community support, right? So one of the initiatives that will be kicking that off is the Crew of the Ghost is obviously one of the big like tent poles of the year, right? They're an amazing cast of characters. They're tailor-made for what Shatterpoint wants to be. They had a huge response last year when we showed them off at the roadmap. So we're gonna be working on a program with retailers where they're going to get a kit and they're going to have special wanted poster promos for... which we showed, I believe, at Mini Stravaganza. So we showed some art of this amazing work that our graphic designer, Ryan Ritter, who does a lot of our Shatterpoint stuff, just created on his own. And he took the character art and he made like these cool little Rebels wanted posters. So those are going to be promotional order cards that are going to go to retailers in this support kit. Okay. And then our recommendation to retailers is like, hey, use these for event support, use them for hobby night, whatever. So that's going to be the first one. But yeah, the goal is to start providing more and more like promotional material and like promo cards, order cards, things like that, other really cool in-game items and things for stores to be able to start galvanizing their communities, running, whether it's a weekly tournament, whether it's a league play, things like that. And then, of course, from the narrative and thematic side, we are going to be releasing more of that stuff. Not necessarily in the same way as... In the past, we did the Crisis Protocol kits as organized play kits, where they were a thing that retailers could pick up and purchase and then run in their stores in a more traditional sense. We want to make sure that those are as readily available to everyone in the community as possible, because not everyone necessarily has a local game store. They don't have a community that necessarily has galvanized big enough that they can run these things. We want people to miss out on those. So those things will be effectively put out, those narrative events and those different game modes will be put out through print and play. And then they will be offered in print for stores through these different support programs as well. So it is absolutely on our radar to like really start to push and drive in-store opportunities with like cool promotional cards, cool, whatever other things seem of value as we talk to our retailers and start getting that out.
That's handy. Yeah, I'm glad to hear the print and play, because I think that's a lot of us like to do the print and play type of the stuff where we're bringing that in and utilizing... To be able to play the games at home, play the different variations of the game. Because, like, my wife, she's like, nah, I'm not going to sit there and sit down and play that game. But if, like, if I were to sit there and bring out, like, the symbiotes in Marvel Crisis Protocol, it's like, okay, well, you have these three. My son has these three. My daughter has these three. And my wife has these three. And, like, now we get to go, you can have Hulk and have Hulk go over there and beat up. I was like, or you have Vader. Vader's going to go and attack over there. They're going to love that. And it's like, I like having the ability to have... that become, you can make it a family game night for Shatterpoint and make it that way.
Absolutely. And as same idea, I have two boys and my wife, and they're kind of the same way, right? They're the boys are getting old enough to where they are interested in doing the 1v1 now, but like when they were a little younger, it was very easy to be like, hey, let's play like a four player free for all, or let's do this thing where it's like semi-co-op, so you three will be on a team and you'll be against me and I'll kind of game master the thing. And I think those experiences are so valuable because, again, the opportunity not only to play with people who are close to you and may not be part of the hobby is wonderful. Like, it's a great experience to share your passions with your family and friends. But also, it's a great way to introduce people, like you said, right? A four-player free-for-all that's kind of chaos, where you have a very limited amount of things to worry about, and you also have players that are semi-working together or can discuss things with each other, allows for people to learn the games in a much less stressful environment.
Exactly.
On board with all of that stuff, definitely things that we want to see, and we're working on exploring. And again, I think, you know, starting back with getting that support into the store so that communities can really start to rally around it, rally around their LGS, and get rewarded for doing what we love people to do, which is play.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And I think I felt like that was like the path that you wanted to go down. And then of course we had COVID that just sort of like, cause I remember it's like you went there, you did the, they had the patches that you got when you like first launched MCP,
yeah.
And there was so much cool stuff. And it's like, then COVID happened. It's like, well,
yeah,
let's watch Will in his laundry room.
Well, let's just watch this guy in his laundry room, like painting some things, you know? It was definitely one of those things. Like, COVID was a really interesting, it was an interesting time. It challenged a lot of, I think, our initial beliefs on how do you support community, you know, what's important. It was amazing to see the hobby side of things really bring people together and give them a way to connect when they couldn't do so physically or across a table. And then now that we've moved beyond that, it's really been kind of a resetting and getting back to normal. And it feels like there have been a lot of hiccups along the way, right? Like, we've won, but yet there's still these things that we're relearning or we're trying to do better now that we have the opportunity to somewhat reset. And so I'm very excited to see like where our plans are going in the next year and how we open up a lot more opportunities for players, not just at the local level, but also at the convention level, to really start to interact and come back together and build on the great foundations that we have.
Outstanding. I'm excited for it. I'm excited for the future.
Yeah, me too. I can't wait to be able to show people at least a little portion of it.
Yeah, I'm excited for Sunday. It's like all the speculation of like, what are they going to show? It's like, especially the teaser from at the very end of Mini Stravaganza,
yeah,
it's like,
yeah,
there's a blue guy there.
There's a blue guy with some red eyes. He looks pretty angry. Yeah,
that was really exciting. So I'm really looking forward to it. But I think that's all I had.
All right.
I appreciate you giving me some of your time today.
Absolutely. No, I'm so happy. Thank you so much for, you know, doing Momentous Struggle and being like one of the centerpieces of the community. Like we get to make the games and we put a lot of passion into it. But the truly humbling thing is watching as the players and people like yourself come together to create these anchors and to really be paragons of the groups around them. And to just see your passion, it makes us want to go back and get right back to work.
Fantastic.
You know?
Fantastic. I mean, we love the game. I mean, like I said, Aubrey and I both, we love Star Wars to begin with. I loved MCP, so it was like, okay, you're taking two things that I love so much and you're marrying them together.
Smashing them together.
Let's do this. I was like, I was all in from day one.
Awesome.
So I was like, I'm very happy about it. I'm excited to see where we go in the future.
Well, we got a lot of exciting things on the horizon. We're going to show, Sunday is going to give you a preview for about the next 12 months. So you'll get to see what's coming a year ahead. And then there's like four more years in here that I can't share yet. So we'll get there.
Well, I mean, that's exciting to know that there's at least 5 years just rolling around in Wilson's
head.
I'm
sure you want to go eat lunch. But as we talk about, right, our production cycle, it takes 2 years to make anything in the hard plastic to get it to the quality and where we think we can make our best work. So because of that, we have to really have a long-term plan. So our minimum is 5 years. So we have everything planned out for 5 years. And then the 3 years, beyond the 2 years, things can shift a little bit. But once you get into that 2 years, it's locked in. So we know that's what we're doing and we know that's where we're going. But we have some very cool stuff coming, like all the things.
It's exciting. So basically, you know what's coming out basically in 2026.
Yes.
You just can't tell me.
Yeah, I mean, some of that
Come
stuff.
Come on, Will.
I know. Some of that stuff, I'll slip it to you in a note under the table later.
No, don't say that, because then I'm going to have everybody DMing me. What's going on? What do we all say?
Here, I'll write it down right now.
Oh, my Lord, it's blowing up. That is fantastic. I'm looking forward to that one.
Yeah.
You're not going to believe it.
You take a picture once I leave. Just be like, I snuck it away. So it is. We are, some of that stuff is in like production now, actually, because of the timeline. So it's very locked in, right? It always makes me laugh when people are like, well, they haven't shown anything in a while. They're clearly not working anything. I'm like, if you only knew how how far ahead we actually have stuff. You know, we got things in the case that are painted at the studio that you won't see for another 12 months.
Wow.
You know,
that's wild. I mean, like, especially on the MCP side, because there was that lull of like releases when you were getting ready for the core box to come out. I'm like, what are they doing over there? They don't get. They're all they care about is Shatterpoint. They're not doing anything for us. And it's like, here's 12 models and a whole new core box. Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, so it's like there's lots of stuff. Every single game, you know, requires so much care, so much thought. The production timelines are really long, so it's all about like working on things. But we have all the plans, and so much of it is in various stages in the works, and we're getting ready. Like, we'll go back and we'll start the next phase of stuff. Nice. Beyond 26. It's a marathon, and it is the most fun marathon I've ever run.
And it doesn't stop.
I don't want it to. No one wants it to.
Nice. That's fantastic. I'm looking forward to it.
All right.
All right. Thanks again.
Thank you so much.
And that was that amazing interview with Will Schick. Again, I can't thank him enough and Atomic Mass Games for having them come on and allowing us to get a little peek into the development side of Atomic Mass Games and Star Wars Shatterpoint for sure. So I do again want to thank everybody for listening to our podcast today, listening to this interview. As always, I do want to say thank you, and may the Force be with you.